Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
We welcome back to the show this morning Brad Woodworth, who is an associate professor of history at the University of New Haven, also has a history of Russia and even President Vladimir Putin. He's been on the show before, and we welcome him back this morning. Good morning, Brad. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. Considering what's going on, I'm doing okay. I wanted to talk about this incredible video that was released over the weekend that has all of, I'd say, the internet just, I think, in awe of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I'm wondering if you saw that video that I'm talking about, his message to the Russian people.
I have seen it. In fact, I've seen it twice. I found it so moving. I just had to watch it again.
Mm-hmm. What was it about having someone like Arnold Schwarzenegger do this video? Why do you find it so compelling, especially in this current climate we're in overseas?
Yeah, so Schwarzenegger is really popular in Russia. He knows he has a large fan base in Russia. And if you've seen the video, he starts off talking not to his fans in the United States or Western Europe. He's speaking to his Russian fans. He's speaking right to Russians. He's hoping the message will get through, and maybe we can talk about this, you know, the problems that the Russian state has put up in allowing information to come from outside Russia. But it's his effort to speak to the Russian people.
Exactly. And I want to actually play a specific snippet of this video that to me is where he, you know, he actually compares the United States and how he spoke out. He brought up the insurrection or he called it the insurrection that happened on January 6th, the attack on our Capitol in Washington, D.C. He brought that up and how he spoke out against that and how there were people trying to control government. He does this parallel. And then he brings up the Russian government. And I just want to play a snippet of it because this is his message to the people of Russia and the Russian soldiers. Take a quick listen.
Same with your government. I know that your government has told you that this is a war to denazify Ukraine. Denazify Ukraine? This is not true. Ukraine is a country with a Jewish president, I might add, whose father's three brothers were all murdered by the Nazis. You see, Ukraine did not start this war. Neither did nationalists or Nazis. Those in power in the Kremlin started this war.
So he continues on in this video, and as both Brad and I have mentioned, I would highly recommend, if you have not seen it, to go watch it. It's a little over 9 minutes long, but it's really powerful and so incredibly moving. And, you know, what do you think about his comments and even the parallel he draws to the fact that America hasn't been perfect in its recent history with the government?
So I think Arnold Schwarzenegger knows that with the actions that the Russian state has taken, there will be a lot of people throughout the world that will have very negative views of Russia. And you could say, of course, rightly so, right? We understand that this the state that represents, at least is claiming to represent 140 million people, is carrying out war crimes in Ukraine. Arnold Schwarzenegger, though, knows from his personal experience, as do I. I first spent time in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, in 1985, that the Russian people, certainly that I met and that he had met, are warm, are kind. Now, we're not seeing that right now. So Schwarzenegger is talking to those people who are not like Vladimir Putin, not like those in his government, and not like those that have been willing to take orders to hurt others. That video starts with a very moving story about how he, as a youngster in Vienna at a world weightlifting championship, met Yuri Petrovich Vlasov, the world champion in weightlifting, and how kind he was to him, and is showing the Russian people that he, that is Schwarzenegger, knows the goodness of Russian people. And then at the end of the video, he talks directly to Russians and saying, look, well, he's talking to the Russians throughout the video, but he mentions a group in particular who are his heroes now. And that is the thousands of people, particularly in cities, in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, who have come out on the street and been willing to risk getting arrested to voice their opposition to this war.
The protesters.
Yeah,
he. I love that parallel, and he's such a great storyteller. How he does that, he sets it up so beautifully, telling this amazing story of when he's 14, and then bringing it back to how they are the protesters are just as strong, if not stronger, than Russian's strongest man. And it's
right. So he's showing there's heroes on. He's bookending that whole 9-minute segment with telling Russians, you have heroes. You don't have to do this.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
You don't have to carry out this war.
Yeah, we're chatting this morning with Brad Woodworth of University of New Haven. He's a historian there as well as an associate professor. What do you think the chances are that Schwarzenegger's video actually makes it to the screens of Russian people?
I think young people who are internet savvy will probably mostly all see it. Right now, the Russian regime has shut down access to news outside of Russia that is shown on television. The state completely controls what people see on television. So if you get your news from television, which is, well, you know, the older generation, people who did grow up with the internet, they're getting their news straight from Putin's mouth, essentially. Younger people have greater access to and who also have greater knowledge of foreign languages, primarily English, but other languages as well, can go outside. Now, that's gotten even more difficult in the last several weeks. And increasingly, to be able to get access to much Western news, young Russians are even using VPNs, right, so that they can so the state's not knowing where their signals originate, where the computer is. But the ability for Russian people now to get news is really, really limited. The Russian state, after the beginning of this, what it's calling a special operations, you cannot in the media call what is happening in Ukraine a war. You have to call it a special operations. If you call it a war, an invasion, you risk 15 years imprisonment. For spreading fake news.
If you call it a war for spreading fake news, wow. Good Lord, if that only happened in America, where would we be? That's unbelievable. So what you're telling me, Brad, is that there's a massive population in Russia that they truly believe they're defending their country and that this is an operation where Russia's defending itself against Nazis in Ukraine. Like, there are really people who believe
that's right.
That's really what they believe.
They believe it because...
They
believe it because they that's all they know. That's what they've been told. And for 20 years, Putin has controlled the media. And, well, it's gotten worse and worse over the last – I mean, right now, it's as bad as the 1930s. I mean, it's not maybe really comparable because, right, because we have the nature of media is different now 100 years later. And you have – and there is possibility of getting outside of – news from the outside if you're media savvy. But many people know what – many people think, according to these lines of praise and compliments and assurance that the Putin regime has been giving, people want someone, a strong figure to believe in, right? We need that as human beings.
Right.
And Putin has made it clear that he's the one to be believed and he's the one that will protect them. And they need protection because, they're told, not only are there – fascists and other horrible figures that want to hurt Russia in Ukraine, but also in elsewhere in the West and in the United States. This is really, really concerning, right? Mm-hmm. That millions of Russians are convinced that the United States wants to hurt Russia, that they always have, and that they always will.
We're chatting this morning with Brad Woodworth, who's an associate professor of history at the University of New Haven, also a historian himself who spent some time in the 80s, actually, in Russia, formerly the Soviet Union. And we've been chatting with him about the history of Russia. But today, specifically, we've been talking about propaganda and really the media. And actually, I'd say like the lack
of knowledge of what's really going on with worldly news because of the control that's been put on the Russian people. So I wanted to talk about the media a little bit. As a journalist myself, I've been in this for over a decade. And my heart, I understand here in America, we love to criticize journalists in some part for good reason, because I do think we've gotten out of control as a whole. I think national news especially has gotten out of control. Network news with leaning one way over another and being too opinionated and not giving the facts and sometimes giving out fake news. That's true. But the job of a journalist, at least what it was supposed to be, what it was intended to be, was to go out and to give people the facts and the figures of what's really going on, whether it's in your local communities, at a state level, at a national level, at an international level. And what I find very troubling, what I don't know if a lot of people know, Brad, I know you do, is that dozens of journalists have been murdered. And it's been confirmed that they've been murdered because of their jobs in Russia since Putin even came into power. And a lot of those cases are left just, sorry, it happened, sorry. And that's the end of it. It's like case closed. There's no investigation. There's nothing behind it. Just, yep, sorry, they're gone. Sorry about that. And I find it astonishing, you know, that has gone on in Russia for many, many years. And it's still, you know, a problem today even.
Yeah, so in Russia today, there's a continuation of an approach to the relationship between society and political power that certainly held during the Soviet period, arguably began even before that, and that is that our top priority should be the state, that our role as individuals is to make – so when we say country, right, that's a broad term that can include people and can include lands.
Mm-hmm.
But when we use the word state – It's this abstraction, right? This idea of power power in the name of a particular group of people with a unified, absolute set of ideas. The problem with putting the state first is that you might be representing some people, but every society is diverse, right? We have diverse views. We even have diverse values. And in a state that values the individual and values their voice and their ability, their right to participate in government, we have to take that diversity seriously. And that's why a free press is so important. Not that there won't be mistakes made, maybe exaggerations, but that we have together the right to voice our view, and that has to extend throughout the political spectrum. So one thing that Putin has done is prioritized the role of the state more than anything. You could even call it statism. There's a long Russian word, государственность, right? To put the state, the государ is the lord, the person that really holds power, like the prince, and that his value, he's going to represent the people, and that and his power, right, his military, his his bureaucracy. That is all important. Mm-hmm. One thing that Putin has done over the last 20 years is highlighted, and this gets back to Schwarzenegger's amazing video. He argues that we as a people, and here he doesn't mean specifically ethnic Russians, but everyone within the state of Russia. What makes us special is that we defeated Nazi Germany, right, in 1945. We defeated this evil. Which certainly was so, you know, carrying out the Holocaust, attacking all of Europe, and he's made this the cornerstone of Russian identity, our victory in the war, and he's come back to that now and argued that, well, so the same kind of people, you know, fascists that were in power in Nazi Germany are in power in Ukraine again, which doesn't make sense with a Jewish president. And so there's many people, Russians, particularly the older generation, that have been brought up on this story that, you know, we as a people, as the people of Russia, defeated Nazi Germany, and now we're doing it again, right? We're
right.
Defeating
it's history
these,
repeating itself. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
how in so many years, though, how have we been able to hide the fact that there's just no way that Ukraine would be made up of Nazis? It's not like they didn't know. I mean, do they really not know that President Zelensky is a Jew, and
so Putin needed to make enemies. He needed to show Russian people these are our enemies, and it's so. What's happening now? So much of the killing, the Russian regime is actually hiding from Russians, right? Mm. The fact of the matter is that many people within Russia have relatives. By the way, the I don't think Schwarzenegger mentioned this, but Vlasov, the weightlifter, himself was born in Ukraine.
Yeah, I know he didn't mention that. No, wow, I didn't know that.
Putin is hiding the fact that he is unleashing his fury at people in Ukraine for not simply bowing down when that Russian military first invaded on February 24th and saying, "Oh, we're so glad that you came."
Right.
And so even people whose native language is Russian in eastern Ukraine, he's murdering, hiding. So he's doing that and hiding that from Russian people because he knows that even that, right, would be opposed. The Russians don't want to kill. They certainly don't want to kill their neighbors. They don't want to kill Ukrainians. But they do. Many have bought into this story that Putin's telling them that our identity is to defend our homeland against fascists. And so that's how he's labeling the Ukrainians.
It's quite the narrative. Brad, I appreciate having you on the show. Like I said, I'd love to have you on more often as this continues to unfold overseas. And I thank you so much for your expertise on this.
It's my pleasure.
All right, we'll check back in with Bradley Woodworth of University of New Haven probably in a couple of weeks right here on WICC. We're checking in now with Senator Bob Duff here on WICC. Good morning, Senator Duff. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. Did you catch any of the St. Patrick's Day parades over the weekend?
Yeah, it seemed to be a lot of them. Everybody was having a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. And it ended up being beautiful. It ended up being really nice.
Yeah, that's good. It's... I actually myself hung a Easter egg tree, did an Easter egg tree on Saturday in the beautiful weather, which I thought was supposed to be rainy, and then hung another tree with Ukrainian colors on it to show some support for them as well, and which I posted on my Facebook and Twitter and Instagram pages. But so it was good. It was a good weekend.
Yeah,
good weekend.
It really was.
It's Monday. I can't believe it's Monday already.
I know. And I feel like we just talked. It's
exactly.
But at least today is spring. It's the last time we talked, it was winter. So there you go.
Right.
That's right. At least we're in a new season.
Exactly.
Senator Duff, I wanted to talk about something. I know you and I have talked about it a couple of times on the air before, but I wanted to rehash it because I know it's on a lot of our listeners' minds this morning. And that's crime in Connecticut. I know you and I have talked about this, that we are certainly not a Chicago. And I wanted to just make that very clear that Connecticut is still considered, when you compare to national data, one of the safer states to live in. But with that being said, when you hear about car thefts and shoplifting, and I know it's not, it's not murders, obviously, and homicides, which is good. We're seeing it happening outside of Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford. We're seeing it in places like Fairfield teachers being held at gunpoint before a car theft happens. A Hamden shopping plaza where there have now been three car thefts in a matter of a couple of months in the same place. Milford, purse thefts happening outside of the mall. We're seeing it in these non-city like areas. And I was curious if we're focusing on these crimes that are going on. Like I said, I know based on national data, we're no Chicago, but I'd hate to get to a Chicago. I don't think we're anywhere near that, but I'm just curious if we're focused on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that let's just be clear, as you said, Connecticut is the fourth safest state in the nation. We don't have anywhere near the crime that, you talked about Chicago a lot, but Florida, nobody moves to Florida for the low gun crime rate or the low crime rate in general. Same with Texas and other states down south. So, I think that, when these things kind of happen and they're unfortunate and we should, need to make sure that we're vigilant, about these issues that I think they do stick out a little bit because they are unusual and it's something that we're not used to. Now, I would say I hate to make the distinction between, you know, all crime happens in Bridgeport, all crime happens in New Haven, because I don't think that's the case either. I'm not sure that's what you're saying. But, you know, we just saw a report last week that based on the numbers, car thefts and juvenile crimes have started to come down since the pandemic, and I think that that's what we would expect and what a lot of us predicted. And much of our crime still went down during the pandemic. So, you know, these kind of other things where if somebody's getting carjacked or there's a purse snatching or other things like that, yes, we definitely need to make sure we're focused on those things. We have to find the cause, who's doing it. The police have to make sure that they are arresting folks and that we are prosecuting them. We have to make sure that we don't have people who are committing the same crime over and over again, and that many of the programs that may have been stalled during the pandemic are restarted again, because that was a huge factor in keeping our crime rate down. And we have to make sure that there's regional cooperation. A lot of the cooperation was starting to happen when you started seeing police departments in the area cooperating with each other because of the fact that our communities are so small, even our cities. So there's a lot of factors that go into our crime rate and ensuring that we don't have the same small group of people continuing to do the same things over and over and over again. Police have to do their jobs. We have to make sure the prosecutors are doing their jobs, and we have to make sure we have the programs to make sure that we get kids diverted away from, you know, these kinds of things that may have happened. Now, they're not all juvenile. We have a lot of adults, you know, who may be committing crimes as well. Same kind of thing. We don't want the revolving door of justice where they just, you know, come in, go out, come in, go out. If people are committing crimes, we need to make sure that we put them away and that we keep our community safe. Obviously, safety is a huge issue. I'm glad of Connecticut's low crime rate. If we see bumps in areas, we need to make sure that our police departments, our state police, and other law enforcement are stepping up and doing what they need to do.
Are you worried at all, though, Senator Duff, that we've seen in the last couple of years our recruitment numbers are down significantly? Like, state police said that they should be somewhere around 1,200, state police troopers, and we have somewhere around 800 right now. Just as an example, are you worried about that?
Well, we're seeing a lot of retirements in our state workforce in general, and especially in our state police. Remember, they have special benefits where they get to work 20 years and they're done. They get full benefits, full pension, full health care after only 20 years. Most state employees have to have 30 years to have that. That same with Department of Corrections. Any kind of hazardous duty is 20 years. It changes with the new people at 25 years. So that it makes them work another 5 years. But there's recruitment issues all over the country, whether it's in red states or blue states. You see in places like Oklahoma, Missouri, and other places, Florida, they're having a difficult time recruiting for law enforcement and in other jobs. I mean, frankly, you know, there's just fewer people in the workforce right now. But in general, I mean, you talk to any position and it's difficult to hire a lot of occupations right now. But I would say that, you know, in our budget, we have funded at least three separate classes of state police troopers. And, you know, unfortunately, just a few of them were let go because of cheating. But I think for the most part, they're all going to do well. They're all going to get on. But the part of it is that it's hard to keep up with the number of retirements that are coming because of the changes in the state employee contract and the mere fact of the age of some of the state troopers that we keep hiring, but we lose them to retirement at a faster rate than we're hiring them. So we'll keep at it. We'll keep funding them. And we have a lot of people who still want to be troopers in the state. It's just a matter of getting them through the classes. They're very highly trained. They're very good at what they do. And so it just takes a long time from the minute they get hired to the minute they actually get on the road to enforce the law.
We're chatting with Senator Bob Duff this morning, and we were talking about youth crime, repeat offenders, what can be done in the state. Even though Connecticut, against the national data, is, I think, ranked number 4 for the safest state to live in, many people are feeling uncomfortable, feeling uneasy about if they go to get their groceries, they get in their car, that they're going to get carjacked, or that something's going to be stolen from them, or they're going to be assaulted. And my last question for you, Senator Duff, before you go. I know, as I mentioned, that GOP lawmakers have been putting proposals out there to try and stop repeat, especially juvenile offenders. As you mentioned, it's not always, you know, young people who are committing these crimes, and sometimes they're not even repeat offenders. They're, you know, first or second time. So the one thing I wanted to just talk about was the ability to transfer youth offenders to adult court. My understanding is, under current law, if you are, for example, committing something like car theft, it may not be automatically transferred to adult court. It kind of comes down to whether or not the judge wants to send it over. Why not make that mandatory?
Well, that's a good question, but I think that what we've seen through the data is that does you need to have judicial discretion on some of that, because sometimes when you send things to adult court on certain issues, it sounds good in the media, it sounds good as a political talking point, but what it ends up does is it makes a adult criminal out of a juvenile, and that's not what we want. We want to have issues where if somebody does a crime, especially a juvenile, then they are punished or they're diverted somehow, and they don't commit that again. We don't need to make more adult criminals in our state that will recidivate and then continually be in jail forever. So I think the data we've seen over the years with making some of those policy decisions, that it's had the exact opposite effect of making our state safe, and therefore we need to make sure that the prosecutors and the judges have that discretion so they can make the very best decision so that these juveniles do not repeat what they've done, and we're not making career criminals out of some of these folks if they end up in adult jail.
So if jail time or going to adult court, if that's not the answer, then what is being proposed to be in place so that they don't become repeat offenders?
Well, that's the whole thing, is that a lot of the programs that we have done that were suspended during the pandemic were working, and we found that, you know, the again, this is why we've seen, if you look at the statistics of, say, car thefts over the last 30 years, mm-hmm. they have gone down tremendously and very dramatically. And some of that, a lot of that has to do with the initiatives that have been put out by the Juvenile Justice Initiative and the judicial branch and working with prosecutors and others. So there has been a huge reduction, I mean, tenfold probably, of youth juvenile crime and especially car thefts. So a lot of what we've done has been working, and the pandemic has changed a lot of that, but now everybody's getting back to normal. We've seen the numbers go down, and so I think we don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Can we make some tweaks and some changes? Absolutely, and there may need to be some. But again, we had the judicial branch finally work with and have that MOU with some of our local police departments. The police departments working together in concert in a regional way. Once some of that was done, we saw reductions immediately in some of the crimes that we've done because they were working together and sharing information. So I don't think that all of this requires major policy shifts. Some of it requires just people working together.
Okay. But you definitely don't feel that courts are just, or that judges, I should say, are just kind of dismissing cases. You don't think that's happening?
I'm not looking at every single case. So if you're asking me if there is one, I don't know. But I'm looking at the data and what the data is showing. And so I feel like that having that judicial discretion is important to keeping our state safe over the long term.
Senator Bob Duff, we appreciate your time this morning, and we'll talk again next week.
Great. Thank you so much.
We now check in with the other side of the aisle. Senator Tony Huang is here. And Senator Huang, thank you for being here. We appreciate it. How are you?
Thank you, Melissa. It's always great to be with you. Happy St. Patrick's Week.
I know. Seriously. It feels like St. Patrick's Day is just forever and everlasting, because we've got St. Patrick's Day parades that all took up this past weekend. It was nice, though. It was ended up being
it
nice weather.
It must have been incredible for Chase, because it's the first time he's experienced it being part of the parade. It's got to have been a great treat.
He was very, I've never seen his eyes so open in his life. He was
so wonderful.
Where did all these people come from? I said, they all live here, buddy. It's crazy. I know, it's crazy. Like, he had never seen so many people. But, I mean, I've taken him to Disney, gosh, 6 times already, and he just, that just was out the window. He's like, this is nuts. I'm like, yeah, it's crazy. But it was very fun. It was very fun. Thank you.
And we segue, and I know you're going to ask me about where we are from a standpoint of crime,
yeah.
And we are indeed a safe state than the rest of the country, and that's the important part of it. And you talk about parades and people gathering, having that sense of safety, a sense of celebration. You know, one crime against anyone is one crime too many, and it's not just about the car thefts. It's also the reckless, brazen incidents, right, that are shockingly very well documented. And indeed, quite real for many of us who've had an opportunity to talk to people whose lives have been forever traumatized by these kind of physical actions. It really is an issue of real importance to people. And I'll share with you an example. In Hampden Plaza, which is a midway point between Fairfield to Hartford,
right.
It's usually a pit stop for me for coffee. And I stopped there to make phone calls and to do a lot of the work before I get up to Hartford. So I'm sitting in my car maybe for a half hour to an hour working.
Mm.
Well, just this last Friday, a elderly 74-year-old woman was violently assaulted,
right.
and mugged and had her car taken. And since 2021 May, they had 4 violent assaults in that area, in that plaza. So for me, as I sit there, now I lock my door. I don't even stop there anymore because why open up the random chance that crime could happen to you? And that's what we're dealing with here. The data doesn't really reflect the brazen nature of these kind of violent actions, of which we're not used to and should never be used to. So I think the first thing I would say is acknowledge there's a problem.
I think that's what's frustrating.
A real problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because even in speaking just a few minutes ago to Senator Duff, I never said that these are only issues that happen in Bridgeport, New Haven, and Hartford. But it was only about a year or two ago that I was told on this show that we aren't seeing these problems in our suburban areas, which was just false. I mean, you had 2 teachers held at gunpoint in Fairfield, and the carjacking happened in the fall. And I had Brenda Kupchick on about that, and she's like, it's a problem. It's happening here in Fairfield. We've heard about it happening in Westport right outside of a salon. I mean, we're seeing these things happening, I'm saying, not just in our major inner cities. And to continue to be compared to the national debt, I don't care. I don't care. I don't want to move to Florida. I don't want to move to Texas. I like living in Connecticut. So why isn't it as safe as I know the number saying we're number 4, but I don't want to know that my car is taken while my 3-year-old's sitting in the back seat sleeping. I don't want to know that when I go grocery shopping, I have to lock my door as soon as I get back into the car. I mean, it's crazy, Senator Wong. It really is.
One crime against anyone is one too many.
Right.
That being said, it happens in our cities far too often. It happens to our suburbs. But the brazen nature of some of these actions are shocking to our moral compass. And to hear that some of these individuals are repeat offenders, people that we know are habitual violators and violent felons, is problematic. So, again, let's address that there is a problem.
Right.
Because before you can solve anything, we need to acknowledge that there's a problem and not stick our head in the sand. And we need to find solutions, right, Melissa? This is what we do as legislators.
Right.
Let's go and find solutions. When you admit there's a problem, then the solutions need to be made with all shareholders. People will point to the police bill. People will, and I would also point that the COVID has an impact. Our substance abuse and the fentanyl and opiate epidemic in our society is a problem. We have challenges in mental health. It is a whole plethora of causes.
Mm-hmm.
Admit there's a problem. Let's work to a solution. But we need to have solutions that incorporate feedback from everyone, every shareholder, law enforcement, judiciary, public defenders, diversionary program. How about education and skill training so people have jobs and a future to protect and invest in? So we need to address it from a standpoint of not just one part, taking away violent, repeat, juvenile, or adult offenders from society to protect us, but also look at solutions to say, what are the causes of these, right? You know, we need to understand that good people can make mistakes,
mm-hmm.
but without opportunity to stay away, without mentors, without guidance and structure and stability, it's very easy to take that risk and chance for that one moment of thrill or one moment of boredom that forever changes your life.
Sure. So it does kind of sound like, Senator Huang, you know, with that example that you just said, you know, it sounds like you agree with what Senator Duff's saying, which is that maybe in some of those cases, if you're not a repeat offender, for example, it may not make sense to send you straight to adult court. But do you agree that there were programs in place to help repeat offenders and youth criminals, essentially, that just have not been available because of COVID the last 2 years, that were making a world of difference? Do you agree?
We have made policies in the last 8 to 10 years that have raised the risk level as well as the tolerance level that may have been a basis for some of the challenges we're enduring. But there have also been some good policies as well. So in some ways, absolutely, I agree that we should never throw away the key for individuals that make a mistake. For whatever the reason, the economic cycle, socioeconomics, education, a learning disability, substance impact, we need to understand that good people can make mistakes. But that being said, we need to create a system that says these violent habitual offenders that everybody knows, it's brazen when you hear a 15-year-old who is a multiple convicted felon who is not in jail committing a reckless, dangerous, violent fatality. It's these kind of crimes are preventable. And for us not to do the necessary things like GPS monitoring, mandatory fingerprinting, looking at next court activity so that these juveniles don't get lost in the system and escape the system, detention orders. We need to do better in regards to looking at these individuals and look at holding them for a six-period, you know, hold limit instead mm-hmm. of a little and hopefully a little longer so that the records – and that's a good point I will share with Senator Duff is that our interrelated systems don't talk to each other.
Mm.
And so perhaps an individual in the system who is a habitual offender doesn't get the information from other systems
right.
that they get released. So we need to increase communications better. That is definitely many of the things we need to do. But to say that there is no real problem, the data is declining, and that we're just going to leave things alone is an acknowledgement that there is no problem, there is a problem, and that perhaps some of the bills that you passed has a majority Democrat by a partisan basis, perhaps might have been a mistake. And for the betterment of the people we represent and serve and protect, that we should go back in and fix it.
We're continuing our conversation with Senator Tony Huang. And Senator Huang, before the break, you had mentioned, you know, maybe we have to go back and relook at policies and laws that were passed by a Democratic majority in Hartford. I'm imagining you're talking about the police accountability law. And if so, what parts specifically do you think at this point should be relooked at and maybe changed?
Well, I think the immunity question that was raised quite repeatedly that failed by an amendment to remove by one single vote. And we need to recognize that many of these policies and this bill particularly came after the very emotional, relevant aftermath of George Floyd, rightfully so. But it was also held in a closed legislative body in which people weren't allowed to interact. It occurred within a short amount of period with limited public hearing, limited public input. Law enforcement felt slighted in their inability to have direct input, and many other shareholders as well. So it might have been a bill well-intentioned, well-needed, but nevertheless ill-devised because of time and essence, right? So, and the lack of shareholder input. So I think we need to go back and look and readily resolve some of the lingering challenges, and it has had a dramatic impact. The documentation is looking at the retirement level of our law enforcement, the mm-hmm. difficulty already in recruitment, and the challenge of a profession that is noble and well served is now struggling to find quality people.
Yeah.
That being said, mm-hmm. it is something we need to do, and it goes back to the crux of it. You know, let's not be stubborn. Let's not be, you know, reticent to acknowledge that we might not have created a perfect document. You know, lawmakers do that sometimes.
Sure.
It is even greater for us to recognize for the better role that we serve in representing and presenting values and creating laws that impact everyone, that we should go back and make the law as best as we could. It is a moving document, is a living document. For us to say, nope, we're not going to do it, we're going to wait for data, when lives and perception of safety is at risk, is troubling. The third area I'd like to also mention, Melissa, is the fact that we also need to address reentry, recidivism. When you hear that in the first year, you have nearly 40% of individuals that have been incarcerated that have reentered the general community go back in. And we need to recognize that second chance is an important part of us preventing crime. It is to be able to support people in the area of reentry, housing, supportive environments, education, physical and mental health for those that unfortunately sometimes struggle with wearing the scarlet letter of being formally incarcerated. Like I said, I truly believe that there are good people who make mistakes.
Absolutely.
And if they make their mistakes, mm-hmm. we as people of kindness and love and forgiveness need to understand we need to support them. Mm. But for those that are the habitual violent offenders, then we need to readdress and say these are individuals that need to be kept away from the general public for mm-hmm. their greater safety. Mm-hmm. It is important for us to have public safety. It is one of the pillars of what we do in government. And for us to say, you know, we've done enough, let's wait it out. Like I said, I will end with this. One crime against anyone is one too many.
Well, and honestly, Senator Huang, I agree. And I think, too, you know, I just think it's very easy to judge, you know, based on data until, God forbid, it happens to you. And please, please, I'm not saying that as a threat. I'm just saying, you know, I sit here as a reporter every single day and I know how much I love my family. And I know I think about it all the time because my brain is warped that way because of what I've seen over years and years of what I've done for a living. But, you know, if I end up in the situation where something does happen in a parking lot and you know, my car is stolen and my child is in that car, I'm raising hell. I'm going to tell you right now. And I would imagine that any lawmaker who would end up in that situation would also do the same thing. And I'd hate to have to wait for something like that to happen for a change to happen, for it to matter, is how I'm going to put it.
I couldn't agree with you more. And to hear those stories for those people that are forever traumatized, mm-hmm. it is not just one that you forget.
Right.
You shake. You look over your shoulders. You feel violated, if not physically, but mentally,
right.
and your privacy. Look, I had my luggage stolen right out of a golf course parking lot when I was 150 yards away, Melissa.
Right.
That is brazen, reckless aggression that says, I'm going to get away with this.
Right. Right.
And it really impacts people's psychology. And then we have these road rampages in our community that violates local laws and you know.
You're right. You're right.
It's the brazen, reckless
yeah.
display and the attacks that's happening that is really alarming and mm-hmm. creates fear. And you know, I'm not going to stop at the Hampton Plaza anymore because guess what?
Yeah, you don't want to be the next
victim. Sitting in my car,
yeah,
working, and then having somebody stick a gun in front of me to say, get out of my car.
Right.
I'm going to get out of my car.
Right. And now, and that's the thing, too, is now you have a trickle effect where now it impacts the Hamden Plaza, for example. Senator Wong, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I do thank you so much for taking the extra time this morning to chat.
Well, it's my pleasure. Again, I love Connecticut. We can do better, and we do need to do better.
Senator Tony Wong, we appreciate your time.